And W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Monica Ricks in New York. The death toll keeps rising in Turkey and Syria, where an earthquake now killed more than 33,000 people. Hope is also fading to find survivors, and medical help is scarce. CBS's Imtiaz Tayyip is in Turkey.
In hard-hit Adana, babies and small children received treatment at a hospital in the southeastern city. Most were plucked from the ruins by rescue workers, but lost in the chaos were their names. With no one yet to claim them, the fear now is the earthquake has robbed these babies of their parents. We know what area she was found in and how she got here, but don't have any address.
Millions there are homeless. Teams are now on the ground in Canada recovering an object shot down by the U.S. Canadian Defense Minister Anita Anand.
The object was flying at an altitude of approximately 40,000 feet, had unlawfully entered Canadian airspace, and posed a reasonable threat to the safety of civilian flight.
This happened a day after the U.S. shot down an object over Alaska and a week after the Chinese spy balloon.
You're going to get tased again.
Put your hands behind your back.
Put your hands behind your back now.
3, 2, 1.
We're seeing more police body cam footage of yet another violent arrest that's turned deadly. This time in Raleigh, North Carolina, where Darrell Williams begged officers to stop tasing him, telling them he had heart problems. Williams' mother, Sonia.
It was like six of them to one of him. And the excessive tasing, I don't think was called for.
Authorities say Williams was being combative and resisting arrest. Cyclone Gabrielle has made landfall in New Zealand. Prime Minister Chris Hipkins.
We don't know exactly what that severe weather is going to entail, but everyone across the country should be prepared for that.
Tens of thousands of protesters back on the streets now in Israel, marching against the government's plan for a judicial overhaul. This woman's in Tel Aviv.
Soon, if they're going to change the laws, we're not going to be able to go out and fight for what we're saying and fight for the rights of minorities and many groups here in Israel.
Critics say the changes will threaten democratic checks on ministers. It is Super Bowl Sunday, and if you're headed to the big game today, chances are you paid a lot of money for those tickets. CBS's Steve Futterman talked to some big spenders ahead of the big game in Phoenix.
This person is lucky. He has a Super Bowl ticket.
About $8,500.
Paid for by his mother.
We've had a lot of rocky moments the past year, so we needed one that kind of celebrated life and victory.
Prices have come down in the last few days, but it's still going to cost several thousand dollars if you want to go to today's contest.
According to StubHub, the average is still about $7,000 per ticket. This is CBS News.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Muskego to Pewaukee, always streaming at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The long-term effects of Wisconsin's redistricting process were apparent in the November elections. A nonpartisan good government group says voters who feel overlooked should not give up. Mike Moen reports.
Democratic Governor Tony Evers won re-election, but Republicans maintained strong control over the legislature. Jay Heck of the group Common Cause points out that Evers maintains his veto power, but he says Republicans still carry a lot of weight, partly because they keep redrawing the maps to their advantage.
There were more votes cast for Democratic candidates statewide than Republican, but the contrast with the legislative elections in the state is so sharp, it almost makes laughable the idea that we have a true representative democracy.
Researchers have said that over the past decade, Wisconsin has produced among the most gerrymandered voting district maps in the country. Heck says voters should look ahead to next year's state Supreme Court election with the hope a less politicized court could eventually revisit the issue. And there could be legislation floated again next year to develop an independent redistricting process. In the meantime, he says the current maps allow a smaller percentage of voters to decide who controls the legislature, leaving other voters behind in fair representation.
Urban areas in Wisconsin have suffered a decline in the shared revenue from the state, even though those people pay taxes.
Heck says that means less support for schools, roads, and other public needs. Analysts say lawmakers representing these areas get packed into boundaries that ultimately diminish their voices at the state capitol. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
Know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold, 1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003. 125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football. You're about to find out. Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday mornings at 8 on The Shaw and on the Civic Media app.
The Shaw 101 FM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com. You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
February 11th, 2023. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you so much for joining me in this second hour of our program. This is, as always, our weekend review, our analysis, our discussion involving you too about the most important stories in the areas of law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. In this hour, as in our previous hour, we're taking your phone calls, Calvin and I, my producer, at 844-967-2789. Welcome your calls, welcome your thoughts and perspectives as we pursue, once again, many of the important stories in law, government, and justice in America. Right before the top of the hour break, we were talking about the former Vice President, Mike Pence, and the fact that in connection with the January 6th investigation being led by the Department of Justice, by Special Counsel Jack Smith, that the former Vice President has gotten a subpoena to appear in front of that grand jury convened in Washington, D.C., to determine whether or not there should be charges against high-level people responsible for bringing folks to Washington, D.C., otherwise inciting the erection, the overthrow of the election on that day, and furthermore, involved in matters related to a conspiracy to overthrow the results of the November election itself. And so all of that going on, obviously Mike Pence has an obligation to do what? He's got an obligation to show up, fundamentally. That's what you've got to do when you've got a subpoena issued by anyone in any court. We know well from previous prosecutions by the Department of Justice that people like Steve Bannon, Peter Navarro, others subject to criminal prosecution for their failure to show up in connection with congressional subpoenas. The same applies to grand jury subpoenas as well. And so Mike Pence almost certainly obliged at least to show up, determining whether or not his testimony will be the subject of litigation focusing on executive privilege. Already some signals by the former president that he, that is Donald Trump, may raise that issue going forward. And Mike Pence continues to be in the news in another area, and that is just this past week, in an unrelated, presumably unrelated matter, not involving January 6th, we know that the FBI conducted a consent search of the home of the former vice president, Mike Pence, in Michigan. The former vice president and his aides had agreed to that search after they discovered a small number of classified documents there last month. And his advisor, his principal legal authority in this area, said this. He said, the Department of Justice completed a thorough and unrestricted search of 5 hours and removed one additional document with classified markings and 6 additional pages without such markings that were not discovered in the initial review by the vice president's counsel. The vice president, the spokesman went on to say, has directed his legal team to continue to cooperate with appropriate authorities and to be fully transparent through the conclusion of this matter. And again, this event, the discovery of this additional document, a part of a consent search comes a day after these reports that Mr. Pence, the vice president, had received a subpoena from the special counsel on this other matter involving Donald Trump's attempt to overthrow the 2020 election. And once again, why is this story important? Well, it's important to understand the difference between the reaction, the response by the former vice president, that is Mike Pence, to cooperation and a consent search of his residence. And by the way, the Pences were not there at the time that the search took place. The difference between that, on the same side of the line, the consent search is permitted by the attorneys and by the representatives of our current president at his home in Rehoboth, in Delaware generally, and at his think tank office after he left the vice presidency. All of those locations also subject to the disclosure of information and documents and consent searches, cooperative searches, basically saying to the FBI, certainly after negotiation, after agreements, understandings about how these things will be done, but giving consent for the federal authorities to come in and do their own search. Witness the difference between that and what happened in connection with the Mar-a-Lago investigation that continues also to animate the news of this past week. In that situation, requests made, as we well know, months, arguably now well over a year ago, to produce documents believed to be in the possession of the former president, Donald Trump. A less than full disclosure of those documents, a grand jury subpoena issued by those, still not full disclosure, the issuance of a federally authorized search warrant in August of last year, a search warrant not on consent, but a result of a determination by a federal magistrate judge in South Florida that there was probable cause to believe that evidence of a crime existed at Mar-a-Lago. And so, again, witness the difference between the Pence-Biden response, consent searches happening at their homes and other locations, and the response to all of this investigation, again, by Jack Smith, unrelated to January 6th, related to the possession, perhaps the taking of documents that should not have been taken by these top-level officials in our government, present and past. Witness the difference between that and the response by President Trump that has indicated all along a less than cooperative attitude. And sure enough, this past week, once again in the news, because we got news just yesterday that there were new classified documents found at Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. Lawyers for the former president turned over to the Department of Justice in January, a few weeks ago, additional, more classified documents, as well as, and listen to this, a laptop belonging to one of Trump's aides that were still apparently at the former president's Mar-a-Lago residence, even in the wake of the August 6th investigation and the search of those premises on that federal warrant. The discovery of this new package, if you will, of documents, which significantly also included an empty folder, again, this according to reporting, this empty folder labeled classified evening information occurred in mid-January, as I indicated, when President Trump's legal team searched the home for yet additional confidential files that may still be there. Why is this story significant? Well, it indicates once again a lack of cooperation, presumably, in doing this much earlier. And second, arguably the most important reason why this story, again, producing not the great numbers of documents, but the fact that one of these classified documents, maybe more of them, were on this laptop belonging to one of his aides, handing over this a binder with these classification markings about that document, other documents a few weeks ago, and also that at least one, if not more of those documents, electronically copied onto this laptop computer belonging to the aide of the former president. Again, why is that significant? It shows for the first time, in my assessment, that the former president, Donald Trump, and his staff are actually doing something with these documents. The great question back in August and continuing to this day, frankly, the question one can legitimately ask about Vice President Biden, Vice President Pence and also President Biden, is what were you doing with those documents? every indication from the cooperative nature of their response that those two were not doing anything with them. They were simply sitting in boxes at homes in this office with respect to the current president in Washington, D.C. Nothing going on with them, not being used for any particular purpose. Here, we have got the first indication that indeed the documents in Mar-a-Lago were being used for some purpose. How do we know that? Transferred in some way, copied electronically into the laptop computer of one of his aides. The question, once again, why are you doing that? What are you doing with that presumably piece of classified information so important, so significant, that it ends up into the electronic laptop computer of this aide? Raises for the first time the notion that indeed these were not simply inadvertently there, sitting there without any activity, but actively being used in some purpose. That should provide an awful lot of concern among all Americans and further indicates something about intent, which we have talked about a lot before when it comes to the possession and the use of these documents. A lot going on, again, in connection with not only our former Vice President Pence, but also our present president and the former president, Donald Trump. Let's take some additional callers here on Morning Cannolis. Joe from Madison, you're calling in. Thanks, as always, for your thoughts, your good comments and perspectives, Joe.
Great information as always, Jim. I really appreciate it. I wanted to just take one step back on a subject of Mr. Pence and his coming in to discuss what he knows with the prosecutors. My question, I'd like two parts to this. First off, I'd been under the impression with some reading that there'd been a great deal of negotiation between Pence's lawyers and the prosecutor in terms of getting him in to testify as a fact witness. As somebody who's done this kind of work, does this usually involve that level of negotiation? Is it to ensure that he's not spilling state secrets that he shouldn't? Or, I mean, I just imagine if I got a subpoena, it would be show up here this day. There wouldn't be a lot of negotiation about what I could or couldn't. So I'd be interested in your speculation on that, why it took so long to make this happen. And then I'd also be interested in your speculation. Another lawyer had said that the fact that Mr. Pence has been chosen to come in to testify to him signified that things are really beginning to race up and that we should expect to see things barreling along. He described it as it's the car chase section in an action film. Right. My question would be, why would that be true if it takes so much effort to get and time and negotiation to get somebody like the vice president, who after all is a government servant, you know, he's paid for with taxpayer dollars, to agree to come in to talk to the prosecutor? Why would that not indicate that there's going to be just as much negotiation on anybody else that's called in? I'd be curious about your speculation on these two points. Thank you very much, Jim. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And Joe, as always, terrific questions about how this works sort of behind the scenes, right? And it's not unusual to begin to offer some thoughts in response to Joe's excellent questions to talk about how this works. I think the first and most important thing, Joe, is the comment you just made at the end, which is it's the lesson of civics from this program and others. When you get a subpoena, what do you have to do? You have to show up. That's first and foremost. And so that is a fundamental notion. That's why I think most people believe that the vice president will indeed be obliged to show up. Right after the break, I'm going to talk more in response to Joe's questions. Great questions about the negotiation leading up to that and why that is important. Stay with us for more of that discussion here on Morning Cannolis.
Civic Media promised you something big to celebrate our new and still growing network of radio stations. When we announced the one-day $1 million advertising giveaway for Wisconsin businesses, you responded.
Just wanted to echo your sentiments about the advertising. That's really a cool deal and really remarkable.
$1 million of free advertising. Now, if you missed this chance to work with our team, go to civicmedia.us and click on the sponsorship tab. One of our local sales pros will get right back to you. Civicmedia.us and sponsorship.
Monday morning at 8, don't miss Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring legendary Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Football, life, and fun.
Earl, you've been driving a Yugo. They just gave you a brand new Ferrari with turbo boost. So enjoy it, brother.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday morning at 8 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
Up North News Radio is Wisconsin's new choice for progressive talk about important state issues. From the team that brings you the news through social media, newsletters, and here on the radio. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Join me weekday mornings from 6 to 8 a.m.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on The Shaw. Sunny skies this afternoon with highs around 48. Southwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Lows level off around 29. Tonight, mainly cloudy skies. High temperatures reach up to 48. Tomorrow, mainly sunny. Mid-40s Tuesday with a chance for scattered rain showers. Upper 40s Wednesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 39 degrees.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK, 540 AM, Waukesha's only news talk station.
Welcome back to our continuing discussion about major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Right before the break, Joe had called in with some great questions about what happens in connection with this negotiation process that we've heard a lot about in connection with the former vice president's plans, presumably plans, to appear in front of the federal grand jury in Washington, D.C., under the auspices, again, of the courts, but supervised by Jack Smith, the special counsel investigating January 6th generally. Joe has some great questions about whether or not this is routine, what kinds of things typically happen, and how do prosecutors go about dealing with these things, and why is it, I think implicit if not explicit, in Joe's question that a vice president should be afforded this opportunity to negotiate his, perhaps with others, her circumstances of appearing. All great thoughts and great questions. Again, the fundamental notion, you get a subpoena, you are obliged to respond in some way. Now, one of the responses, of course, could be to run into court and seek to have that quashed, basically having a judge find that it's maybe improperly been issued. Highly, highly unusual, highly, highly irregular. We're not talking about a trial here. We're talking about investigation. And there can also be limitations, if you will, on the circumstances, the kinds of things that a witness appearing before the grand jury can testify about. We mentioned executive privilege as one of them. Very limited in this particular circumstance because, again, you're not talking about major issues, but arguably could be the subject, likewise, of a presentation to a federal judge, someone contesting this. But the issue about negotiation, does that happen? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. It's not unusual for defense counsel representing a defendant summoned, subpoenaed to appear before a federal grand jury to call up an assistant U.S. attorney like me, like others, call up a U.S. attorney and say, you know what? We understand our obligation to respond. We would like to talk with you, number one, perhaps about the timing of it. We don't know exactly when Vice President Pence is scheduled to come in. But more importantly, want to talk with you about whether or not we can provide that information, for example, in a non-grand jury posture. That's a possibility in the discretion of the prosecutor. We want to talk with you about some other things related to that. Privileges we may raise, depending upon attorney-client privilege or a medical privilege, a health provider privilege, those kinds of things. I want to talk generally about information, cooperation, if you will, along the way. Not unusual. Doesn't happen in all circumstances. Often witnesses will simply show up on the day and the time of their appointed appearance and appear before the grand jury, questioned by the assistant U.S. attorney, by the federal prosecutor. But it does indeed happen. It doesn't happen in all cases, but it's not atypical, and it could be a part of the process. In the end, understanding, however, as Joe's comment and question underscores, this is a grand jury subpoena. It's not really a matter for negotiation about whether or not compliance should happen, but if indeed there are ways in which the government, the prosecutors, can in fact get the information in a way that also satisfies some interest, not nearly as compelling as the government's, that can be negotiated. It should not, to Joe's good point, take up a huge amount of time. And if indeed there is negotiation that is obviously intended to delay the proceedings, prosecutors like me, like others, will say, you know what, we're no longer going to pursue this. Just show up on that day and we'll talk to you in the grand jury. The vice president, the former president, others involved in this process, others involved in grand juries throughout this country, 93 different districts, every single week. People testifying before grand juries, all of them are responsible to do what? To show up. They are sworn, and they are responsible for testifying. Why? Because no one is above the law. We know that from things like the Mueller report. We know that from cases that are issued by federal district court judges and appellate court judges all the time. Everyone, whether you're the vice president, a former president, whether you are the president of the United States of America sitting in the White House at the time, you are obliged to abide by the rule of law. We know that because that is the foundation upon which our nation is premised. And so we hope that the investigation here continues with the cooperation of the vice president, although we're going to hear an awful lot more about that because of who he is and the fact that his testimony, as I said, incredibly important, incredibly fact-based, obviously has to be at the top of Jack Smith's list, is important. This other comment about the fact that this may in fact be leading toward a return of an indictment or indictments, probably so. The notion that maybe you don't call in the vice president until you're pretty much sure what all the others have said around him. At the same time, again, difficult to believe that the former vice president is a target or even a subject of the investigation, given his involvement in pushing back against Donald Trump. Unlikely that he will be charged with anything here, more likely a fact witness, but nonetheless, someone you would talk to perhaps near the end of your grand jury or general investigation, anticipating, as we have talked before, that there will in fact be some indictments coming soon. The focus of Joe's call, other callers, time is of the essence. And yes, indeed, Americans, including me and others, getting increasingly concerned about the passage of time absent any returns of federal grand jury indictments, state indictments as well, related to these events. Greg from Madison, also on our lines this morning. Greg, glad to have you with us. Your comment, question, or perspective?
Yeah, I had two questions. I've heard this referred to by some Republicans as raid, and I was just wondering if you could tell me the difference between what a raid is. Yes. And what happened at Mar-a-Lago? I heard it have to have a court order, I believe. But how did they know that the documents were there? Sure. Was there somebody from on the inside? You know, asked question number two. Was there somebody on the? Would they have to have somebody on the inside that knew what was going on to get this court order?
Absolutely. Greg, terrific related questions, and so pleased to revisit some of these issues. Let me begin with this fundamental notion about how it is you get a grand jury, I'm sorry, a search warrant to pursue a search of the sort that we saw in August. We're going to talk about that right after the break. Do a little bit more civics here on Morning Cannolis. Respond to Greg's great questions about language and also process. So stay with us for that continuing discussion right after this break.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. More than 33,000 people have died after the earthquake in Turkey. CBS's Imtiaz Tayeb.
At least 6,000 buildings have collapsed. 900,000 people need urgent shelter, and around 5 million have been displaced from their homes.
Canada's defense minister, Anita Anand, is weighing in on the unidentified object shot down by a U.S. fighter jet near the border.
It appears to be a small, cylindrical object and smaller than the one that was downed off the coast of North Carolina.
Tickets to this year's Super Bowl may be cheaper than last year, but people are still paying thousands. Correspondent Steve Futterman is there.
This man says he's priced out.
You have tickets?
Nope.
Are you trying to get them?
Nope.
Why?
Too expensive.
It will be free to watch on television, and up to 100 million people are expected to do just that.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Monday morning at 8, don't miss Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring legendary Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Football, life, and fun.
Earl, you've been driving a Yugo. They just gave you a brand new Ferrari with turbo boost. So enjoy it, brother.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Monday morning at 8 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
It makes me smile, and you have a piano, but if you can play the Peanuts theme song.
Oh, oh my gosh.
You know he can.
Yes.
On the Devil's Radio.
Yes. Yeah. I love it. Listen to Max Inc. Radio Saturday night, 6 p.m. to midnight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. And we are now on the air in Waukesha. Live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw. Turn on, tune in, and help us rebuild the American dream. Check out our website at thericksmithshow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw.
Governor Tony Evers, Tim Michaels said you had gone, quote, full woke. Dr. Jill Underlie said that somebody who says that has no idea what we're doing in schools to make sure kids feel safe.
We want to make sure all kids feel supported. Tim Michaels, we don't teach CRT in our schools. You got to come to the present century here, Tim, and be cognizant of what actually goes in the schools. My guess is you've never been in a public school in Wisconsin.
Up North News Radio with Pat Krylo airs at its new time from 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays across Civic Media.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
It is the Monday after the first Packers game, and I think everyone right now is licking their wounds.
But I do love that you're leading with The Bears Still Suck as the intro song. I mean, we're already on to week two.
Why are we not good at the season opener?
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on The Shaw, 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
If you can plan barbecues and weddings, you can plan to protect yourself from a natural disaster. Sign up for local alerts, prepare an emergency kit, and make a family communications plan. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
And we are back for our final half hour here on February 11th of 2023. Morning Cannoli is talking about issues related to government, law, and justice in America. Right before the break, a phone call from Greg, who had some great questions about language and also about process, and said, you know, what do we know about this notion that there's an allegation that the Mar-a-Lago event was a raid on that property? How do we know that there was a proper government involvement in that search at the time? Great questions, Greg. Let's go back and do some basic civics on just that issue. Under the Fourth Amendment, as we know well, in our Constitution, since the first Congress of our nation, the Fourth Amendment basically says that every single American has a right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures established by our founding fathers. And what that means is before any government official, any federal official, and yes, it applies to the state as well, through state provisions of the same nature. Before you can go in and search a premises, you have to have what's called probable cause to believe that there is evidence of criminal activity, of a crime, either being committed or having been committed inside that property. And so, Greg, to answer you the first portion of your question, this notion that I can simply raid a place by getting up in the morning, whether I'm in law enforcement or even some private citizen, and make the decision that I'm going to bust down a door of a residence, of a business, is simply ridiculous. And the reason why people talk about this being a raid is obvious, right? It is to suggest that, indeed, the proper process under the Constitution was not followed. And you did just simply have the government unilaterally violating the Fourth Amendment rights of individuals on the other side of that door. That does not happen. Or if it does, in those rare instances, those officials, those government agents who conducted a raid, absent a search warrant, or, as we've learned recently in connection with the current president and former vice president, absent getting consent to come in, which is the other way of doing this, if you simply raid a place, go in and knock down a door, you have violated the Constitution, and you are subject to civil lawsuit for violation of those criminal rights and constitutional rights under our nation's fundamental principles. So I would offer that there's no such thing as a raid in proper procedure. That is an attempt to try to induce all of us to think that indeed the government's done something wrong. It did not, in connection with the search, the proper search under the Fourth Amendment of the Mar-a-Lago premises. And what happened there? Greg, as you asked most appropriately, what happened, of course, is that the government, the Department of Justice, presented to a federal magistrate judge, an appointed judge in South Florida, with about 30, almost 40 pages of information to establish probable cause. And Greg, you asked about, gee, is somebody on the inside there who provided that? And the answer is almost certainly yes. I'd even say yes without the almost certainly. Why? Because we know that in order to establish probable cause, you have to have somebody who says what? Who says, you know what, I've been there. I've seen in a desk. I've seen in a drawer. I've seen in a closet. I've seen in an office some documents. I've looked at them. I know that they're there. I've seen them recently. It's a very important part of any search warrant that there be recency. That is, I can't simply come in 6 months later and say there's evidence of a crime in this particular house or this particular business, because the judge will look at me, will look at the investigative agents and say, well, how do you know that they're there now? How do you know that if we go in, I authorize you to go in tomorrow morning, you will find them today? That's also a part of probable cause. You also have to be specific about place. Where are you going? It can't just be a general search in the area. You've got to have that inside person to come forward and say, I saw them in this office. I didn't see them in a residential area. I saw them in a garage. I didn't see them in a car. And so investigative presentations to a federal district court judge, or in this case, magistrate judge, are also always premised upon that kind of particularity, that specificity that ensures, number one, that the Fourth Amendment is followed, that you don't simply have a raid where people go in and kick doors down without authority. And in how do we know that in this situation? Well, we know that because we've gotten a copy of the much redacted supporting document, the affidavit presented by the federal magistrate judge, by the federal investigator, that showed all of that information. Do we know who said what? Do we have the identities of those people and specifically what they said about where they saw documents and the documents themselves? The answer is no, because all of that has been redacted in the release of that document way back in the fall of last year. At some point, whether the case is indicted and goes to trial or that document is otherwise released in the context of a pretrial hearing, pretrial proceedings about the propriety of that search, we may, in fact, know more about that affidavit. But what we do know is that there were 30-some pages of information supporting probable cause, not a raid, a probable cause premise to go in and authorize, through that magistrate judge, the official search of that property. You didn't need to do that with respect to President Biden, the location in Washington, D.C., the two homes in in Delaware. You didn't need to do that with respect to the home of the former Vice President Pence. Why? Because they consented to have those searches done. They're cooperating. In the other instance, you've got this non-raid Fourth Amendment properly executed search warrant in Mar-a-Lago. Very important. Good questions, Greg. Again, an opportunity to engage in some civics lessons here on Morning Cannoli. So thank you for that question, those observations about the way in which we use language in America. Not a raid, a search warrant properly issued and properly executed by federal agents responsible for following exactly what a federal judge told them to do. Let's talk about some other things going on in America also in connection with federal enforcement of the law. We know in recent times that there has been this trend, not unknown in the past history of America, of people attacking power grids, principally in the northwest of our nation and now also on the east coast in Maryland of our nation. An attempt plainly to bring power down to affect the operation of our nation. And so we know that just this past week that a fellow named Brandon Clint Russell, he's 27 years old, comes from Orlando, Florida. Another woman named Sarah Beth Daniel, 34, of Catonsville, Maryland, were charged with conspiracy to do what? To attack one of these power grids in Maryland, to destroy an energy facility, according to the release of the indictment against them that was announced by the U.S. Attorney in Maryland. Each of them for the attack on this power grid in Maryland could face a maximum sentence of up to 20 years behind bars in federal prison if convicted on that charge alone. So what do we know? What do we know about those folks, again, engaging in this not unknown, very troubling, very concerning practice growing across America once again to attack our power grids as a way of undermining our nation? Well, related to these new charges that were announced just on Monday, Russell accused of, again, conspiring to carry out attacks against this critical infrastructure of our nation, specifically this electrical substation in furtherance of his, and this is from the charging document itself, racially or ethnically motivated violent extremist beliefs since at least June of 2022 to the present. The allegations in particular against Russell are that he encouraged, yes, once again, balloons in our news, encouraged the use of Mylar balloons to short out a power transformer. And in a conversation that the investigators retrieved way back from October 25th of last year, of 2022, Russell encouraged that the attack be carried out, quote, when there is greatest strain on the grid. For example, when everyone is using electricity to either heat or cool their homes. These are things that Russell said, now a part of the investigation. Why is that important? Because it establishes his intent to do this, not simply somehow a negligent interference with our power grid, but an intentional, purposeful, criminal intent to bring it down at the time of highest use, and also, again, tying him to these violent extremist beliefs that are also a part of his social media presentation. In conversations on encrypted communications applications, Russell posted links, some open source maps of the infrastructure, things you can get out there. Those included some locations of these electrical substations, indicating exactly where he was going to do this, how he was going to do it. And he described, believe it or not, a small number of attacks on substations, how those could cause what he called a cascading failure to support power in our nation, specifically in Maryland. And again, discussed maximizing the impact of that planned attack by hitting multiple serial substations all at one time. Now, the other defendant, Clem Daniel, who is, again, a woman in Maryland, allegedly collaborated with him on this plan, discussed her desire for this attack in some conversations, also now a part of the investigation. She allegedly stated that if they hit 5 electrical substations all in the same day in the Baltimore, Maryland area, again, these things coming from her own voice, her own words, they would, as she said, completely destroy this whole city. Again, showing her intent to undermine the safety and security, the livelihood of that part of our nation. Went on to say, and that would happen for a good 4 or 5 shots through the center of them, meaning her attacks upon these power stations, and that should make that happen. That is to bring down the electrical grid and stop power from being disseminated to the populations in that area. She further added, it would probably permanently completely lay this city to waste if we could do that successfully. All of that, again, according to the complaint against her and her co-defendant, Russell, in this major, major prosecution. Why is this happening? It's being pursued and produced by the government publicly to let other people know out there who might consider doing the same thing, that not only will you be stopped, and again, an important thing about this particular event is it did not happen. Why? Because good law enforcement identified this, saw this happening on social media, saw these encrypted messages and arrested them, brought them into the criminal justice system before they could do what they planned to do. But again, deterrence, the all-important issue here, right? Alleging in this complaint that we know what these folks did, we know what they were planning to do, and as a result of this, we are seeking and we have gotten, based again upon probable cause to believe that you have committed a crime. We talk a lot about deterrence on this broadcast. Once again, why is this important? Why is it important to know about this? Because it does stop these particular individuals, these two who not only had some incredibly inappropriate, violent biases, as I indicated, some ethnically, racially motivated communications, purposes that are also implicit in this prosecution, to stop them in particular. That is called specific deterrence, specifically stopping them from doing what they plan to do, identifying both of them and bringing them into the criminal justice system. Secondarily, having this broader impact upon the larger community. As I said, this is not the first time we have seen this before. We've seen this in the northwestern portion of our nation as well. If there are other people out there who are thinking of committing this kind of activity, engaging this conduct that plainly is intended to stop the operation of not only government, but more importantly, arguably, the basic operation of who we are, how we live, how we conduct our lives, raise our families, educators, commercial entrepreneurs, business, commerce, arts, sports, all those kinds of things that rely profoundly upon power. If you're going to do that, we will probably be on top of you. We will identify who you are, and we will stop you not only before you will do that, but we will charge you in federal district court, arguably also in state court. There are also state violations, plainly, that can be charged here as well. We'll stop you from doing just that. So specific deterrence as to them, and also specific deterrence, general deterrence as to others who might also be out there thinking about this crime. As an important footnote, Brandon Clint Russell had a former roommate a number of years ago who murdered 2 other roommates following a dispute on a conversion to the religion of Islam. Again, a whole lot more detail coming out of that. But this is a fellow who is not unknown to racism, not unknown to anti-Islamic positions, and so appropriately today in federal custody for his attempt to attack America. We're to continue with another important part of our program this morning as we memorialize another person who left us just this past week. Stay with us for that discussion. Personal point of privilege here on Morning Cannolis.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripescast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a 6-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
My fine guest, Maggie Dawn, attorney at law. I thought that the laws of the United States were supposed to evolve with societal norms. The vast majority of Americans, 70% approximately, believe that Roe v. Wade should be the law of the land. So that seems exactly contrary to the way the courts are supposed to evolve with our nation.
I'll just say this. The guy in Colorado can't be forced to make a gay wedding cake, but I can be forced to make a baby. I don't know about you, but that makes no damn sense to me.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
You care for the house, the kids, and our future. A Shiro's day is never done. So let's start saving a little more now. Get free tips to help boost your retirement savings. Visit AsiaRetirement.org.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
We stand on the shoulders of women who came before us.
Women who fought for their own financial futures.
And now it's our turn.
Join us. Visit WeSaySaveIt.org and take control of your financial future by saving for retirement.
A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Sunny skies this afternoon with highs around 48. Southwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Lows level off around 29 tonight. Mainly cloudy skies. High temperatures reach up to 48. Tomorrow, mainly sunny. Mid-40s Tuesday, with a chance for scattered rain showers. Upper 40s Wednesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 39 degrees.
WAUK 540 AM. Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Is our final segment this morning on Morning Cannolis on February 11th of 2023. That music you're hearing right now, the music of Burt Bacharach, left us this past week. He died at the age of 94. This lion in the area of music who animated us, who instructed our lives through lyrics and music, stays with us, a continuing legacy. In these last moments, I want to talk with you, a point of personal privilege, about another individual who may not have animated us through music, but through both his presence, his activity, his professionalism, and his humanity, has been an important part of our community in Waukesha, in the state of Wisconsin, and I would offer throughout the United States of America. This past week, on the same day that Burt Bacharach died, a fellow named Bill Hotz, William Hotz, H-O-T-Z, also departed our company on this planet, but he stays with us and his legacy continues. I want to tell you a little bit about him. He's a friend, he's a partner, and he is an important part of our continuing focus on what America should be all about. Bill was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and yes, also a lawyer. The University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School graduated with honors many years ago. A long and professional career in banking accomplished. Greatly respected by his peers, by those with whom he had adversarial relationships in the courts and beyond, in banking in particular. A tremendous attorney representing clients well, thoughtfully. We talk a lot about the rule of law in this program. Bill was the rule of law when it comes to all the things that he did in his service as a lawyer and did things based upon a pursuit of justice. He worked for a couple of years in the Capitol, the Madison Capitol, our state capitol, in the Legislative Reference Bureau, and that also underscores Bill's concept of service to his nation and to his state. The Legislative Reference Bureau, of course, these folks, these lawyers, who are the ones who actually write the laws upon the direction of our legislators, incredibly important work. Bill, again, distinguished himself in that area and in many other areas. We could go on and talk at great length about his legal career, stunningly wonderful and important in legacy to this day. I also want to focus upon the fact that Bill and his equally spectacular spouse, her name is Susan, she is a businesswoman in her own right, also very established in this area, also a part of our area focus upon the rule of law and promoting decency and common good in this state. Indeed, Bill and Susan, many years, longtime members of Common Cause Wisconsin, members, donors also. Bill was on the board of directors of Common Cause Wisconsin, among other things, as a part of his advocacy for rightness, for goodness, for things that should be a part of our state and our nation. Bill actually was in the United States Capitol. The Madison Capitol, also in the United States Capitol in his past, but specifically in Madison, at the Capitol, on many occasions. Among those recently, testifying against legislation that many of you will recall well that destroyed the nonpartisan Government Accountability Board. Bill, a great advocate, along with Susan and others, opposing that legislation. Also opposing legislation that destroyed basically Wisconsin's campaign finance laws, saying that there's a reason for those laws to ensure integrity in our political system and ensuring that people who are elected are not there simply because of money, but are following the rules to get your votes legitimately. He also was an advocate against a measure to exempt politicians from prosecution under the state's John Doe laws. All these pieces of legislation introduced a number of years ago in an attempt to undermine the rule of law. Who was there to stop it, to try to stop this activity? His name is Bill Hotz, and he was there as an advocate for you, for me, and for people who believe in the rule of law and things right and current. Bill and Susan, the entire Hotz family, including their daughter, Jessica, also an educator. Bill and Susan, great educators, people, academics, who wanted us to know about things going on, invested in their daughter, Jessica, also a school teacher and educator here in the state of Wisconsin. Big education focus in their lives, and big focus upon, yes, also partisan politics and supporting those candidates who advance the things that are good and right in America, focusing upon education, on healthcare, on commerce, on the arts, on immigration, on things that are important to all of us, especially in the areas of voting rights and elections that we have talked a lot about. That was and that is Bill Hotz. We remember him today. As we think about him and knowing that I was going to be talking about my good friend and continuing partner, Bill Hotz, many people wrote to me about Bill, commented to me about things like his respectful nature, his diplomatic demeanor, his intelligence, his informed approach to everything that he did. One of my friends said he was always precise, incredibly well-informed, not only in those public demonstrations of who he was and what he meant when he talked about advocacy for America, but also in private discussions, respectful, diplomatic, even being articulate and being clear and even strident from time to time, appropriately so, in advocating for what he thought was right. Articulate and persuasive, the words used. One of the fellows who was from Common Cause, actually the director of Common Cause, some of the leadership there said he was one of the most nice, kind, generous, and caring people you could possibly imagine. Indeed, everyone who knew Bill during the course of his important life that continues to this day know that about Bill. We remember him today. Let me talk again and quote to you exactly something that one of Bill's colleagues and friends here in Waukesha in the state of Wisconsin wrote about Bill Hotz, who died again this past Wednesday. His legacy continues. What Jeff said about Bill was just this. What I remember most about Bill Hotz was his quiet yet determined demeanor. His steadfast commitment to democracy and the rule of law. Isn't that right? Bill was that special, kind, patient, focused, and methodical soul, Jeff wrote, who could calmly endure 142 interruptions in the course of a political conversation, and then, when finally given his chance to speak, would always make the very best points among everybody gathered here during the course of that conversation. All of those things from Jeff, from others throughout the community, celebrating the life of Bill Hotz, brought to an end just temporally, just physically on this earth, but again, a life that continues to animate all of us in not only the expressions that he articulated, the time that he had with us, but his legacy continues. We are all better for Bill Hotz, for that life. We are diminished in his absence only slightly because, as I said, his legacy remains with us now and always. Godspeed, Bill, as you go about the next portion of your life and your livelihood with us as a sign of what can and should be America in the 21st century. And with that, I thank you all for joining me this morning on Morning Cannolis. Join me again next week for more of our discussion about life, livelihood, for law, government, and justice in America. Have a good week, everybody. Take care.
As the nose tackle for the green and gold,
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003,
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Monday mornings at 8 on the Shaw and on the Civic Media app.
Hey, this is Matt from Design Garden. Remember when the internet was new? Back then, you had to leave your house to start a business. Companies used to pay programmers bags of cash to get online. Now, small businesses can get online with a Facebook business page, or Squarespace, or Google My Business, or WordPress. But which tools should you use? Can you afford to go down the wrong path? Design Garden uses modern tools to build your website the right way.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.